Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. In this audio, I'm covering 2 Samuel chapter 21, in which David avenges the Gibeonites that Saul had killed earlier. And we'll also look at some miscellaneous wars with the Philistines, or battles with the Philistines. Our context is this: David has just finished putting down Absalom's rebellion and Sheba's rebellion, which followed thereon. And he's made peace with all the different political elements of his kingdom, and he's gone back to Jerusalem to rule in the last days of his life. And so the last several chapters of 2 Samuel, chapters 21 through 24, are sort of mopping up details, sort of summaries of what happened during David's reign. So we start now in 2 Samuel 21:1. Now there was a famine in the days of David for 3 years, year after year. And David sought the presence of the Lord. And the Lord said, "It is for Saul and his bloody house, because he put the Gibeonites to death." Now this famine occurred in the days of David. Exactly when that was, a couple of options. It could have been after Absalom's rebellion, which Bible Hub Timeline puts at 976 BC. This would make sense. The story is told right after Absalom's rebellion has been finished up in the previous several chapters. And so Bible Hub Timeline has this famine at 970 BC. The timing is really not that important, but that's one option, is after Absalom's rebellion. Another option, it might have occurred before Absalom's rebellion, and that would make some sense too, because it's closer to Saul's sin of having executed the Gibeonites in violation of Joshua's covenant with the Gibeonites, and that would have been closer to the crime when Saul was alive. And also, if you date it after Absalom's rebellion, then you're talking about a long time that Saul and Jonathan's bones remained up at Jabesh Gilead and not taking back to the kingdom. But that's just speculation. Adam Clark says it's unknown when it took place, and that's the best option. We don't know. But we're going to say it happened after Absalom's rebellion. Just because it happens next in the text, that's not an indication of perfect certainty as when something happened. It just makes it easier. So these 3 years, there was a famine. The first year, David probably said, "Well, we had a bad crop this year. Hope we have a better crop next year." But now the second year of famine, he might think, "Well, we must have done something wrong. The nation must have done something wrong." Remember the curses in Deuteronomy 28 and 29? One of the curses was a brass sky, no rain falling out of it. But when the third year of the famine comes around, David must have figured that, boy, somebody has really sinned here. 3 straight years of famine? David might have thought, "Yeah, it might be because of my sin, because of what I did with Bathsheba and Uriah." We don't know, but it was a bad, bad famine. So David seeks the presence of the Lord. You wonder why he didn't seek the presence of the Lord the first year. It could be because of human nature. When everything else fails, pray. It's not the way we operate, but it ought to be, as soon as something goes wrong, pray immediately. But David apparently didn't. Now, how did he seek the Lord? Well, it could have been through the high priest using the Urim and Thummim, that mysterious means of discerning God's will that was kept in the breastplate of the high priest, in the fold of the breastplate. David could have sought the Lord through Nathan the prophet, who was a very accomplished prophet in his court. Could have been he just made personal prayer and said, "God, what's going on here? Is it because of my sin? Is it because of the nation's sin?" Well, the Lord answered and said, "I'll tell you why you haven't had any rain or haven't had any food in 3 years. It's because of Saul and his bloody house. He put the Gibeonites to death." Now, where this occurred, we don't know. It's not recorded anywhere else. When Saul did this, we just assume at some time he did. Well, what's the big deal? Why putting the Gibeonites to death would cause a three-year famine? Well, because Joshua had promised the Gibeonites not to slay them. Now, you remember the Gibeonites had hoodwinked Joshua when Joshua had just entered the land. Joshua is on a mission to exterminate all the Amorites, all the Canaanites in the land. The Gibeonites realized they were in trouble. They also knew that the Israelites were not tasked to kill people outside the land of Canaan, so they pretended they were outside the land of Canaan by putting on a bunch of old clothes, dusty clothes, worn out implements. I forgot exactly how they did it, but they just came into Joshua's camp looking old and worn out and said, "Well, we've been walking from a long way. So don't kill us. We're not allied with these Ammonites in your promised land. And we're not allied with these Amorites in your promised land." And so Joshua said, "You got it. We're not going to kill you." But Saul broke that promise. And so there was retribution for it, namely a 3-year famine. So we go now to 2 Samuel 21, verses 2 through 4. The Gibeonites were not Israelites, but rather a remnant of Amorites. The Israelites had taken an oath concerning them, but Saul had tried to kill them in his zeal for the Israelites in Judah. So David summoned the Gibeonites and spoke to them. He asked the Gibeonites, "What should I do for you? How can I make atonement so that you will bring a blessing on the Lord's inheritance?" The Gibeonites said to him, "We are not asking for money from Saul or his family, and we cannot put anyone to death in Israel." And David responds, "Whatever you say, I will do for you." Now in verse 2, the Gibeonites are stated not to be Israelites, rather they became proselytes of the Jews. They became hewers of wood and drawers of water, as you remember. In other words, basically slaves, or servants at least. In verse 2, the Gibeonites are called a remnant of the Amorites. The Amorites is a general term for Canaanites of all the different tribes that lived in Canaan. Sometimes they're called Amorites, sometimes they're called Canaanites. The Amorites were a large, large tribe. Their name ended up on the Egyptian monuments, and so sometimes they're given the honor of the name for all the Canaanites in the land of Canaan. They were actually Hivites, more particularly Joshua 11:19, the Hittites living in Gibeon. Now in verse 2, it says the Israelites had taken an oath concerning the Gibeonites, but Saul had tried to kill them in his zeal. Did Saul actually carry out the killing of the Gibeonites? I would say yes. David gave 7 the sentence of Saul to be hanged in this chapter, as we'll see when we get to it. And verse 5 of this chapter says Saul consumed the Gibeonites. That sounds like Saul, yeah, he did carry it out. He killed him. I don't know why it says he tried to kill him, unless it means he tried to exterminate them all, and he failed to kill them all. Maybe that's what it means. Now, Saul didn't just willy-nilly murder the Gibeonites for no reason. He had a reason. It was for the zeal for the Israelites in Judah, says in verse 2, his zeal. So Saul was using the divine law concerning the extermination of the Canaanites as a pretext to kill Gibeonites. His real motive probably was to get the possessions of the Gibeonites, and the people of Israel apparently went along with Saul. They made no attempt to stop the attempted massacre, thus there was a national punishment for the whole nation. I say attempted massacre. The nation made no attempt to stop the murder of however many Gibeonites Saul did kill. So even though the law said you could kill the Canaanites, there was a covenant made with the Gibeonites that the Israelites were not to kill them in particular, but Saul did it anyway. So David asked the Gibeonites, "How can you bring a blessing on the Lord's inheritance?" And what he means is, how can you stop this curse? In other words, we're not asking anything except just get back to the status quo ante before the rain stopped falling. The Gibeonites' reply says, "Look, we're not asking for silver or gold, because silver or gold is not going to atone for the murder of the Gibeonites." The NIV translates it differently and says, "We have no right to demand silver or gold." In other words, they had no legal right to demand justice from Saul's family because they were Amorites and thus legal outcasts from the legal system that would allow them to get justice from Saul's family. So they're saying, "We don't want silver or gold. Silver or gold's not enough to atone for what you did to us. And we cannot put anyone to death in Israel," which probably means we have no legal ability to put to death any of Saul's descendants. It could mean we cannot put anybody to death because we have no desire to put anybody to death. Depends on how you read it. I think what they mean is we have no legal means to get justice. And so what the Gibeonites are saying to David is, "We're going to leave it up to you. What do you say?" And David says, "Well, whatever you say, I'll do it." 2 Samuel 21, verses 5 through 6. "So they said to the king," the Gibeonites did, "the man who consumed us and who planned to exterminate us from remaining with any border of Israel," and that's where the tried to kill the men of Gibeon, "he murdered some, he killed some, but he didn't succeed in completely exterminating us. Otherwise, David wouldn't have anybody to talk to right now. There would be no Gibeonites at all." So basically, Saul's intent was to wipe them out, and he failed in that attempt, but he did kill some in the attempt. So in verse 6, the Gibeonites say, "Let 7 men from Saul's sons be given to us, and we will hang them before the Lord in Gibeah of Saul, the chosen of the Lord." And the king said, "I will give them." Now, why did the Gibeonites ask for 7 men to be given to them so they could execute them? Why 7? Well, here's some options. Option number 1, Saul had only killed 7 Gibeonites, so they wanted 1 descendant of Saul for every Gibeonite killed. Well, that seems unlikely, especially when you look at verse 5, which says that Saul had consumed the Gibeonites and had planned to exterminate the Gibeonites, probably kill more than seven. Here's another option why they asked for seven. The Gibeonites knew that there were only seven descendants of Saul left eligible to be killed, besides Mephibosheth, of course, because David was never going to kill Mephibosheth because David had made an oath to Mephibosheth in 2 Samuel 9:7. Don't be afraid, David said to him, since I intend to show you kindness because of your father Jonathan, I will restore to you all your grandfather Saul's fields, and you will always eat meals at my table. So Mephibosheth is not going down, and I suppose the Gibeonites perhaps knew of that promise. Maybe they did, maybe they didn't, but at any rate, that wasn't going to happen, but maybe there were seven other descendants left only. Well, seven descendants of Saul are going to be mentioned here in the next several verses. Two sons of Saul's concubine Rizpah and five sons of Saul's daughter Merab. Maybe that's all that were left. And maybe the Gibeonites knew that, so they said, give us seven men. I think the best reason, though, why seven men are mentioned is because seven is the sacred number of perfection and completion. Now, Ellicott says that. The Cambridge Commentary says that. The Pulpit Commentary says that. And actually, I thought of it before I even looked at the commentaries. The problem with that, though, is that the Gibeonites were not Israelites. Perhaps they knew that seven was a sacred number for the Israelites, and therefore they asked for seven people. I think that's probably reasonable. Or it could be there were only seven descendants left of Saul. I don't know. But at any rate, seven were asked for. And the Gibeonites said they will hang them before the Lord. John Gill says the Gibeonites were not wanting to hang the seven men in a spirit of revenge. They wanted to honor the justice of God in order to appease the wrath and end the famine. Because remember, the Gibeonites are in the land of Israel too, and they're suffering the famine also. Gibeon is just 5-6 miles to the northwest of Jerusalem. Now, as I read this, I think they were probably looking for justice. They weren't probably looking for revenge. It's hard to judge from this distance. And the people of Gibeon wanted to hang the seven men in Gibeah. We have to distinguish the two places. Gibeah of Saul, about 3 miles north of Jerusalem on the main road north. Gibeah was Saul's hometown, so it's a perfect place to hang these descendants of Saul in Saul's hometown. It was also the capital seat of his kingdom. Gibeon is northwest of Jerusalem, about 5 miles, not straight north of Jerusalem as Gibeah was. They're close, but they're not the same place. So David doesn't seem to hesitate a minute. He says, okay, I'll give you these seven men. Now, here's some problems with David doing this. First of all, the first problem is David had promised Saul he would never cut off his descendants, and here he is cutting off his descendants. We read in 1 Samuel 24:21-22, first part of the verse. Saul is speaking to David. This is in the cave at En-Gedi, where David had a chance to whack Saul, and he didn't do it. And so Saul says to David in 1 Samuel 24:21-22, first part of the verse, therefore swear to me by the Lord that you will not cut off my descendants. You will not cut off my descendants or wipe out my name from my father's family. So David swore to Saul. So David's already sworn to Saul that he's not going to cut off his descendants, and here he is cutting off his descendants. David had also made a covenant with Jonathan, Saul's son Jonathan, not to kill Jonathan's descendants, who of course would be Saul's descendants also, but just to drive home the point, 1 Samuel 20:15-16, Jonathan says to David, don't ever withdraw your faithful love from my household, his descendants, in other words. Not even when the Lord cuts off every one of David's enemies from the face of the earth. Then Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David. So David has promised not to kill Jonathan's descendants. Well, here he is. Now, these aren't Jonathan's descendants that he's killing, but he's killing Saul's descendants. So how do you square those covenant promises, or at least that one covenant promise to Saul at En-Gedi, not to kill Saul's descendants? Well, John Gill speculates that perhaps it is because God's divine direction overruled David's oath. Gill goes on to say it appears that God was pleased with David's actions here. And I ask, where does it say anywhere in this text that God was pleased? Where does it even intimate such? I don't see it. I think the best answer is this. When David promised Saul that he would not cut off Saul's descendants, what he meant was, I'm not going to wipe them all out. After all, David did leave Mephibosheth, so he promised, even if he killed all the other seven. Mephibosheth still left, so he didn't cut off Saul's descendants. All right, so I think that answers the first problem. Now, the next problem is why would God ask for capital punishment for people who didn't commit the crime? Where's that famous verse, which unfortunately I don't have in front of me, but it says that the one who sins shall suffer for his own sin. These seven sons or seven descendants of Saul, seven sons of Saul, they got executed for something they didn't do, apparently. Well, the answer to that is, one answer to that is that the persons chosen were directly involved with Saul in the attempt to exterminate the Gibeonites. Adam Clark doesn't believe that. He says, quote, but where is the proof of this? Well, no, there's no explicit proof, but it does seem reasonable that people high up in Saul's administrations back then tended to be rife with nepotism. So these sons probably helped Saul to exterminate the Gibeonites, in which case they got what they deserved. Here's another reason that it is very probable that these seven people who were executed had something to do with the crime, is that the whole nation was suffering. The whole nation was suffering a famine. Why would God punish the whole nation unless it's the leadership of the nation that did the thing for which the punishment was meted out? This is what Jameson, Foss, and Brown say about this, quote, and if it should seem unjust to make the descendants suffer for a crime which, in all probability, originated with Saul himself, yet his sons and grandsons might be the instruments of his cruelty, the willing and zealous executors of this bloody raid. I think that's reasonable. But now, if you think that his sons did not participate in killing the Gibeonites, but nonetheless they were killed, and you're still hung up on the second objection, why would God ask for capital punishment for people who didn't commit the crime? Here's another possible answer to that. God allowed innocent individuals to suffer for the nation. I have a hard time with this one. This is Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. Quote, God in his providence suffered the Gibeonites to ask and inflict so barbarous a retaliation in order that the oppressed Gibeonites might obtain justice and some reparation of their wrongs, especially that the scandal brought on the name of the true religion by the violation of a solemn national compact might be wiped away from Israel, and that a memorable lesson should be given to respect treaties and oaths. And so that solution is, well, the reason God allowed capital punishment for people who didn't commit a crime is they were sacrificed to the nation and to the honor of God's treaties. I have a hard time with that one. Doesn't seem just to me. Well, here's another possible response to people who are upset that God would ask for capital punishment for people who didn't commit a capital crime, is that God, as a matter of fact, did not require human sacrifice. Nowhere says in this text that God approved of what David did. It just says David did it. Adam Clark said God does not approve of this. It's really not human sacrifice, it's capital punishment. Human sacrifice sounds like it's a religious thing, but it's capital punishment. Adam Clark says this, quote, certainly not. What he means is certainly not God requiring capital punishment for crimes that the people being punished didn't commit. Certainly not. God will not have man's blood for sacrifice no more than he will have swine's blood. The famine might have been removed and the land properly purged by offering the sacrifices prescribed by the law and by general humiliation of the people. Well, Kyle and Delitzsch disagree with Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. They say, no, David was fulfilling the law when he did this. Numbers 35:33, do not defile the land where you are. This is the law. Do not defile the land, for bloodshed defiles the land, and there can be no atonement for the land because of the blood that is shed on it, except by the blood of the person who shed it. And of course, the problem with that is the person who shed it didn't appear to be Saul, but rather his descendants. So I'm assuming that Kyle and Delitzsch are assuming that the descendants participated in the murder and therefore the land needed atonement. That's the easiest solution to this. And my humble opinion is just to say that these seven were involved in the murder of the Gibeonites and the land cried out for justice because the land was defiled. And so life for life, blood for blood. Now, notice all this, as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say, had nothing to do with David wanting to get rid of claimants to the throne. This is not political here. The seven that he delivered up to the Gibeonites were only in collateral branches of Saul's family, and they had never claimed sovereignty, and they probably never would have. So this is not a political thing. This is a religious thing. We go down to 2 Samuel 21, verse 7. But the king spared Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, because of the oath of the Lord which was between them, between David and Saul's son Jonathan. Again, David's not going to offer up Mephibosheth as one of the seven. We've already mentioned that oath. 1 Samuel 20, verse 15, Jonathan says to David, don't ever withdraw your faithful love from my household. That would include his descendants. And Jonathan made the covenant with David. We go now to 2 Samuel 21, verses 8 through 9. So the king took the two sons of Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, Armoni and Mephibosheth, whom she had borne to Saul, and the five sons of Merab, the daughter of Saul, whom she had borne to Adriel, the son of Barzillai, the Meholathite. Then he gave them into the hands, as David gave these seven into the hands of the Gibeonites, and they hanged them. The Gibeonites hanged the seven in the mountain before the Lord, so that the seven of them fell together. I'm assuming the mountain is in Gibeah, because that's where they wanted the hanging to take place. The seven of them fell together, and they were put to death in the first days of harvest at the beginning of barley harvest. Now, who is this Rizpah? Verse 8, that's Saul's concubine. She's mentioned earlier in 2 Samuel 3, 7. Now, Saul had a concubine whose name was Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah. And Ishbosheth said to Abner, "Why have you gone into my father's concubine?" Remember that nice story. The last remaining son of Saul is ruling over the northern 10 tribes while David is south in Hebron, and that remaining son Ishbosheth says to his general, "Why have you shacked up with Rizpah?" That led to Abner's defecting to David. He was pretty ticked off by that, if you recall the story. Rizpah's other son, besides Mephibosheth, is Armoni. He's not mentioned anywhere else. And by the way, this Mephibosheth is not the famous Mephibosheth that David had a covenant with that showed who was lame in his feet and David let him eat at his table. That was Saul's grandson. Saul had a son, Jonathan, and Jonathan's son was Mephibosheth. This is Saul's son through his concubine Rizpah, Armoni, and Mephibosheth. In fact, this older Mephibosheth mentioned here was probably whom the younger Mephibosheth, the grandson, was named after. Now in verse 8, we've got five sons of Merab mentioned. Now, most of the modern translations have Merab. The KJV has Michael. It's a big textual problem here. Let me read just to summarize it. Kyle and Delitch quote, "The name of Michael, which stands in the text, is founded upon an error of memory or a copyist mistake, for it was not Michael, but Merab, Saul's eldest daughter, who was given to Adriel the Meholathite as his wife." We read that in 1 Samuel 18:19, which I won't read, but that's what it says. Merab is married to Adriel, and here it's Merab is married to Adriel, the son of Barzillai the Meholathite. And so it can't be Michael. But the King James says Michael. It turns out that most of the manuscripts, Hebrew and others, I think even the Septuagint has some manuscripts, have Michael, not Merab. I think it's a minority of texts that have Merab, but it doesn't make any sense that it's Michael. So we're going to take Merab here, who, of course, was Michael's sister. In verse 9, the Gibeonites hung the seven on the mountain before the Lord at Gibeah, so everyone could see the mountains. They could see the bodies because the bodies were up on a mountain. They were said to be hung before the Lord. This was to show that these bodies were meant to appease God's wrath because the law had not been followed. They hadn't had any rain. Verse 9 says that the hangings, the executions, were done at the beginning of barley harvest. And by the way the Israelites hung people, they killed them first and then hung their bodies on the cross as an object lesson to the population. They didn't hang them like in the Old West with a noose around their neck. That's the way most ancient Near Eastern nations handled executions back then. They were executed at the time of the barley harvest, of course, Nisan 14, which is April/May, our calendar. Nisan 14 was Passover. Nisan 15 is the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And the second day, Nisan 16, is the Feast of the Barley Harvest, or the first fruits of the barley harvest. And so when it says the beginning of barley harvest, or the first days of harvest, it's probably somewhere around Nisan 16 in May. Now, that's of no consequence, really, the date, except it might tell us how long the mother of two of those seven, Rizpah, how long she stood out there warding off the crows and the vultures. Now, the Gibeonites, by hanging the bodies on the mountain there, they probably planned to let the bodies hang until the rain came down to end the famine. Now, the Jews were bound by law to take bodies that were hung, to take them down by sundown, but the Gibeonites were not Israelites. They were Hivites. They were Amorites. They weren't Israelites. That law says in Deuteronomy 21, verses 22-23, "If anyone is found guilty of an offense deserving the death penalty and is executed, and you hang his body on a tree, you are not to leave his corpse on the tree overnight, but you are to bury him that day. For anyone hung on a tree is under God's curse. You must not defile the land your God has given you as an inheritance. But the Gibeonites weren't Jews, and so they probably were going to hang the body up there till the rains came. We go now to 2 Samuel 21, verse 10. And Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, took sackcloth and spread it for herself on the rock from the beginning of harvest until it rained on them from the sky. And she allowed neither the birds of the sky to rest on them by day nor the beast of the field by night. So no vultures, no tigers, no lions are going to get her sons. She left them up there. She took sackcloth and spread it for herself on the rock. I assume that's so she could sit on it, but it could mean she made a canopy to protect herself from the weather. John Gill and Jameson Fawcett and Brown suggest that could be she used the sackcloth to cover the bodies of her sons. That's not really what it says, though. She said she spread it for herself. The text says she spread it for herself on the rock. So I'm assuming she's sitting on it. She warded off in the beginning of harvest, somewhere around April, May, and barley harvest, somewhere around Nisan 16, until it rained. Now, that rain could just be some unspecified shower that came. Or it could have been the next former rain, the latter rain being in spring and the former rain being in the fall. Now, if that were the case, then it means that Rizpah guarded her son's bodies for 6 long months. I don't really believe that. I believe it's an unspecified shower of rain. Now, remember, keeping the body up day after day was a violation of the law, but it was the Gibeonites doing that violation, not Rizpah, so she's not to be held responsible for that. Now, why did she stop guarding the corpses when the rain came? Well, I suppose this is when David gathered the corpses' bones, which we're going to read about in just a minute. And David started gathering the corpses' bones when it had started raining. The bones haven't been gathered. There's no need to guard the bodies anymore because there's no more bodies to be guarded. So that's why she stayed up there before the bodies on that sackcloth, beating off the vultures and the lions. Think about this, the beast at night, a woman beating off beast at night, and wolves. Wolves and lions love to eat dead bodies. That woman had guts, Rizpah did. We go now to 2 Samuel 21, verses 11 through 14. When it was told David what Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, the concubine of Saul, had done, then David went and took the bones of Saul and the bones of Jonathan his son from the men of Jabesh-Gilead, who had stolen them from the open square of Beth-shan, where the Philistines had hanged them on the day the Philistines struck down Saul in Gilboa. He, that's David, brought up the bones of Saul and the bones of Jonathan his son, Saul's son, from there, from Jabesh-Gilead, and they gathered the bones of those who had been hanged. Those are the 7 that were hanged in Gibeah. They buried the bones of Saul and Jonathan his son in the country of Benjamin in Zelah, in the grave of Kish his father. Kish, Saul's father. Thus they did all that the king commanded, and after that God was moved by prayer for the land. Now why did David take the bones of Saul and Jonathan from Jabesh-Gilead to mix with the bones of the 7? Well, David wanted to show he was not engaged in personal revenge against Saul's family, as John Gill points out. I mean, you take 7 sons of Saul to get killed, it sure does look like a personal vendetta against the family that caused you so much grief for most of your adult life. But rather, no, David wanted to show he was interested in justice for Gibeon. He was not interested in personal revenge against Saul. So he got, as a matter of honor, Saul's bones, as well as Jonathan's bones, from Jabesh-Gilead. Now, if you recall, after the Battle of Gilboa, or Jezreel, which was right in front of Gilboa, to the west of Gilboa, the Philistines in Beth-shan, which is a city a little bit to the east of Mount Gilboa, right there in the Jordan Valley, is present-day Scythopolis. The Philistines took Saul and David's corpses nailed up on the wall, and Jabesh-Gilead had been delivered by Saul at the first of Saul's reigns there, just over the Jordan River to the east, across from Beth-shan, and so they went over about 10 miles or so. They could look, they'd probably see Beth-shan across the valley. They went through that valley to Beth-shan and took down Saul's body and Jonathan's body, came back to Jabesh-Gilead and buried their bones there under a tree, and so David went up there to get those bones. In verse 13, he gathered the bones of the 7 who had been executed. How did he do that? Well, perhaps the bodies had been hanging so long the flesh was consumed and the bones dropped to the ground, and David gathered the bones from the ground. Or it could be the bodies were taken down and the flesh was burned off the bones. At any rate, David's got the bones. He goes to a place called Zelah, which is in the tribe of Benjamin. This is where Saul's father Kish had his grave, his family grave site, and they buried the bones there in honor. Where is Zelah? Well, if you look at Jerusalem on the map, and I say you go about 3 miles north to Gibeah, well, instead of going 3 miles north, go about 1.5 miles to the northwest, and you get to Zelah. So it's right down there in the tribe of Benjamin, right north of Jerusalem, real close to where Saul ended up setting up his city in Gibeah. Saul was probably born in Zelah. The BibleAtlas.org map has the Zelah named as Haleph, H-A-E-L-E-P-H. I don't know why, but it's the same place. After the bones are buried, God is moved by prayer. And what that means, of course, is that God answered the prayers. The NIV translates it. And this is not after the burial of the seven sons in Zelah in the tribe of Benjamin, but rather after the seven sons of Saul had been killed. Atonement, blood atonement for the land having been accomplished. We go now to 2 Samuel 21, verse 15. Now, when the Philistines, we're changing subjects here. Now we're going to go through some miscellaneous battles that David had with the Philistines. Now, when the Philistines were at war again with Israel, David went down and his servants with them. And as they fought against the Philistines, David became weary. Now, when did these Philistine wars take place that we're getting ready to read about? Well, they could have occurred after Absalom's rebellion, because that's what comes next in the text. If you want to take the text order as the chronological order, which is not necessary to do that, but it could be. And it says that David is weary. Well, excuse me, not that he's personally weary, but the fact that his kingdom might have been weary because it had been weakened by the civil war, and that might have invited the Philistines' attack. So it makes sense that the Philistines would come after David again. Also, David became weary. He's more likely to be weary at his older age, which is after Absalom's rebellion, than at his early age when he first became king in Jerusalem. Well, okay, so we're going to take it. The wars took place after Israel. They could have taken place after the war with the Ammonites at the beginning of David's reign over the entire kingdom in Jerusalem. The reason that might have been happened, because that's how the Philistine wars are placed in our parallel passages in Chronicles, 1 Chronicles 20. Again, yes, if you go by the order of the text order is different in Chronicles than it is here in Samuel, so maybe that's not the way to go. Maybe we just use some logic here. The Philistines are probably going to come after Israel now because Israel is weak because of that civil war. We go now to 2 Samuel 21, verses 16 through 17. Then Ishbi-Benob, one of the descendants of the giant, whose bronze spear weighed about 8 pounds and who wore new armor, and that's talking about Ishbi-Benob's, not the giant, but Ishbi-Benob's bronze spear weighed about 8 pounds, and Ishbi-Benob wore new armor. Ishbi-Benob intended to kill David, but Abishai, son of Zeruiah, came to his aid, struck the Philistine, and killed him. Then David's men swore to him, "You must never again go out with us to battle. You must not extinguish the lamp of Israel." David being the lamp of Israel, if he got killed in battle, his lamp would be extinguished. Now Ishbi-Benob is said to be a descendant of the giant. Well, the giant sounds an awful lot like Goliath, because he's sort of a prominent giant in David's history, and I think that's what it is. The NIV translates giant there as Rapha, as a proper name. Ishbi-Benob is a descendant of Rapha. I like the giant better. Another option is a descendant of a giant, of a giant race. Well, we're going to go with Goliath here. Ishbi-Benob has a spear that weighs 8 pounds. That's 300 shekels. That's half the weight of Goliath's spear, which is about 15 pounds. So he might be a giant, but he's not like the granddaddy giant, Goliath. Still, 8 pounds on a spear, that's relatively heavy, and somehow David got himself in trouble here. He's about to get killed. He's rescued by Abishai, who was, of course, David's nephew, his sister Zeruiah's son, and Abishai is the brother of Joab, David's commander. Now, Ishbi-Benob is about to kill David. He's wearing new armor. What's the big deal about new armor? Well, it's probably a mark of honor. The NASB has, he has a new sword, but sword is not in the original text. So Adam Clark says it's probably a new coat of armor. And that's the way the Holman Christian Study Bible has it. Probably an honorific thing. David was exhausted. He couldn't fight anymore. And Ishbi-Benob's about to bump him off. Abishai saves his neck. And as a result, they said, that was too close a call, David. No more fighting for you. And of course, David has spent the early part of his life fighting all the time. no more. This, of course, reminds me of that famous scene at the Battle of Spotsylvania in the American War between the States. Or maybe it was the Battle of the Wilderness. I believe it was the Battle of the Wilderness. My memory's a little fuzzy. Robert E. Lee, the beloved Southern Confederate general, was at the front, and his men grabbed the reins of his horse, and they started shouting to each other, "Lee to the rear, Lee to the rear," because by golly, they didn't want the Confederacy's lamp to be extinguished at that battle. And a Civil War battle is pretty dangerous if you're at the front. We go down to 2 Samuel 21, verse 18. Another miscellaneous incident here. Now, it came about after this that there was war again with the Philistines at Gob. Then Sibbecai the Hushathite struck down Saph, who was among the descendants of the giant. Gob is called Gezer in 1 Chronicles 24, which means probably the place had two names, or the two places were very near each other. That reminds, speaking of Civil War battles, the war between the states, there was a famous battle at Antietam, as the Yankee histories like to call it, but the Southerners called it Sharpsburg, because Sharpsburg was by Antietam. Antietam was the name of the creek, Sharpsburg was the name of the village, and so the battle got two different names. And that happened here. This is otherwise an unknown battle, where Sibbecai the Hushathite struck down Saph, a descendant of the giant. That's probably Goliath again. I tell you, Goliath, he cast a broad shadow on the history of David, did he not? Sibbecai is mentioned as one of David's worthy gentlemen in 1 Chronicles 11:29. He's called a Hushathite, and that perhaps refers to the fact that he was a descendant of Husha, who was of the tribe of Judah, as mentioned in 1 Chronicles 4:4. Again, a minor detail. Verse 18 is a totally minor detail. This is just a listing of David's victories. We go now to 2 Samuel 21:19. There was war with the Philistines again at Gob. Apparently Gob was a, wherever that was a favorite place to fight the Philistines. And there Elhanan, the son of Jaarorgilgam, I like the NIV's translation there, or their note, or the son of Jair the weaver, I can pronounce that. The son of Jair the weaver, the Bethlehemite, killed Goliath the Gittite, the shaft of whose spear was like a weaver's beam. Well, now we have a textual problem here. Elhanan did not kill Goliath the Gittite. That was David. That's a famous story. All those Sunday school stories you heard. If you went to Sunday school in the old days or vacation Bible school, you sure didn't learn it in our Antichrist public schools. But it was David who killed Goliath, not Elhanan. And in addition, Chronicles has Lami as the one who was killed, not Goliath. 1 Chronicles 25, and there was war with the Philistines again, and Elhanan, the son of Jair, killed Lami, the brother of Goliath the Hittite. So the easiest solution to this problem is a textual corruption in 2 Samuel. The Chronicles version being right, of course, because it wasn't Elhanan who killed Goliath, it was David. So 2 Chronicles is right here, and Adam Clark say this about this problem here in 2 Samuel 21:19 is a most manifest corruption of the text, a gross mistake of the transcriber. David, not Elhanan, slew Goliath. This is plain. And in fact, the KJV fixes the problem by saying Elhanan slew the brother of Goliath the Hittite. They inserted brother in there as a guess as to how to fix it. Now, it was the shaft of Goliath whose spear was like a weaver's beam. That's kind of sort of, that comes from the story of David and Goliath. Goliath was famous for having a big spear there like a weaver's beam, if you recall the story. We go now to 2 Samuel 21, verses 20 through 22, and we will be finished with this chapter. There was war at Gath again. That's where Goliath was from. That was one of the five Philistine cities. There was a man of great stature who had six fingers on each hand and six toes on each foot, 24 in number. And he also had been born to the giant. Again, I believe that's Goliath. Goliath was from Gath, and Goliath was a giant. Verse 21, when he, this 24 freak, this 24-fingered and toed freak, when he defied Israel, Jonathan, the son of Shimei, David's brother, struck him down. These four were born to the giant in Gath, and they fell by the hand of David and by the hand of his servant. Now, those four that were struck down that were born to Goliath, I'm assuming it's Goliath. Number one is Ishbi-benob in verse 16. Number two is Saph in verse 18. Number three is Lami, the brother of Goliath, in 1 Chronicles 20, verse 5. And number four is this unnamed giant with 12 fingers and 12 toes. Now, Jonathan, the son of Shimei, killed him. Shimei was David's brother, so Jonathan was his nephew. You see, a lot of these battles, these military battles, were a family affair. Now, Shimei is mentioned here, David's brother. He's worth a mention here. Shimei had another son besides Jonathan, who killed the 12-fingered, 12-toed freak giant. Besides that, Jonathan, Shimei had another son named Jonadab, and Jonadab was famous for giving Amnon the advice on how he could rape Amnon's sister, how Amnon could rape his sister Tamar. So Shimei had two interesting sons, to say the least. Ladies and gentlemen, with these miscellaneous details, we have now finished 2 Samuel 21, verses 20 through 22. Now, in our next chapter, which is chapter 22, we're going to see that the whole chapter is basically a psalm, and that psalm is repeated in Psalms 18. So I'm not going to go over that until we get to the psalms. I'm going to put it in the collection of the psalms, and we're going to skip that. And then we'll go to chapter 23, and we'll see the last words of David, as well as the listing of David's mighty men. So I hope you join with me in our next audio to bid David goodbye as he shuffles off his mortal coil, or as he's getting ready to anyway. And I hope you enjoyed this audio as well.